Well, I'm still Eve Prang Plews. I was 12 minutes ago, and I still am now. And I'm going to be talking about Easter. And I don't know, I've got great memories of Easter. My mother really did it on the holidays. You know, growing up an only child, but then you knew that. My mother made this great big basket, and I had the big chocolate bunny in it, which is everybody's favorite, the giant chocolate bunny. And then there were the marshmallow eggs, and then there were the little robin eggs, the little malted balls, and then there was the little yellow chickens, and then there was the jelly beans. And the only thing that was hard was trying to figure out how much to eat before you went off to church and how much you could get away with eating without getting sick. And like the rest of the American children, red jelly beans were definitely my favorite. Now, I didn't eat any more than my share of the 90 million chocolate Easter bunnies that are made for Easter every year. 90 million of them. 90 million chocolate Easter bunnies. That's really astounding. But it's not as astounding as realizing that there's 16 billion jelly beans that are made for Easter. Fill a 9-story office building up and you've got an idea of what 16 billion jelly beans are. Actually, 5 million marshmallow chickens are produced every day just to prepare for Easter, and they're produced every day because they keep forever. You know, when they have a nuclear war, the only thing that will be left is toilets, cockroaches, and probably peeps, because those are things that can't be destroyed. And so I got some peeps. I got sugar-free peeps because we know that they're so much better for you to be free of sugar. And then I turned the package over. And it said serving size, 3 chicks. So there were 3 chicks, 60 calories in one package, and there's no saturated fat, no cholesterol, and no sodium, and no fiber, and no sugar, and 1 gram of protein. Ooh, so that must be good for you. And its ingredients included maltitol, isomalt, polyglycol syrup, sorbitol, gelatin, calcium chloride, natural flavors. Natural, see, it's natural. Yellow number 5 dye, sucralose, potassium sorbate as a preservative, because you know you have to preserve all that sugar, and my favorite, carnauba wax. And I know how many of you are out there in the listening audience that have a wax deficiency, and you missed eating your candle. But, you know, one of the things that I love on a package of candy for children is the warning that says excessive consumption may cause stomach discomfort and a mild laxative effect. So if your kid's stuffed up to their eyeballs, you can just get him some of those sugar-free peeps and we can have a release with a mild laxative effect and stomach discomfort. Actually, you know, that doesn't sound bad. Maybe you should fill the entire Easter basket with these sugar-free peeps. And maybe if your kid did get stomach discomfort and a mild laxative effect, they wouldn't want them anymore. Doesn't it just scare the bejabbles out of you when you read a label and there's nothing in there that's food? Not a single thing that is listed on the ingredient that we can really call food. Remember, if it ends in an O-S-E, it's a sugar. And if it ends in an O-L, it's an alcohol. Maltitol, polyglycol, sorbitol. So that's where the laxative effect is coming from, is from the sugar alcohols. But it brings us to Easter and Easter candy. No, I don't want to be the wicked witch of Easter and tell you you can't have any Easter candy. I'll be looking forward to my chocolate bunny, hint, hint, husband. Dark chocolate, that is. But we really have to look at the habits that we have when we go from one candy holiday to the next, especially with our kids. Christmas, and then 6 weeks later we have Valentine's Day, and this year 6 weeks later we have Easter, and then we've got Mother's Day, and then it just goes on and on. And we got a head start on Christmas with Halloween. So there's one candy event after the other, one candy event that is so profound that 5 million marshmallow chickens have to be made every single solitary day in order to prepare enough stash for Easter. And by the way, these sugar-free peeps are left over from last year. And when I press on the package, they're just as fluffy as ever. I'm so glad that they put the potassium sorbate in there as a preservative, because these will keep forever. Just forever and ever. Hallelujah. Hallelujah. We got to really think about it, because what happens is we eat with our eyes as much as we do with our mouths, and that's one of the things that captures us are these beautiful, bright colors. All the vivid colors, all the brightly colored packages, all the organic shapes, all the things that draw our eyes to Jell-O and Fruit Loops that are colored with bright synthetic dyes, because they have to turn really unattractive slop into something that looks like alluring edibles. We have to understand the difference between something that's edible and something that's food. And we have to start by looking at these dyes. You know, dyes are pretty complex organic chemicals. And they originally came out of coal tar, and now they just simply come out of petroleum. And I know you wake up in the morning and think, oh, I've got a deficiency of carnauba wax, and I also have a deficiency of petroleum. Yeah, I don't think that's actually happening. And so when we look at all those artificial dyes, I remember going to a class one time, and the teacher was really cute, and she talked about the fact that what happens with all the dyes that we eat is they fall down to the end of your fingertips and your tips of your toes, and that's actually what nail polish is. Silly girl. But colorings are used almost solely in foods of low nutritional value, like candy and soda pop and gelatin desserts. You know, when we look at all of those artificial colors that are out there that are made from petroleum, we have to ask what benefits come from them. And you hear a big blank, because there are no benefits that come from these artificial colors that get added to so many of our foods. But they're cheaper, and they're more stable, and they're brighter than natural colorings. And so it's just easier for companies to use these complex chemical dyes instead of using things like beta-carotene and paprika and beet juice and turmeric. But in Europe, they did it different. In Europe, those dyes are banned, because they found out that it affected children's behaviors. You know, we always talk about how sugar wires our kids. And I mentioned in last week's show on sugar that I didn't actually see that happening, that sugar got our kids all wired up. But what I saw is that many foods contain mixtures of dyes. And those dyes are the things that wire our kids up. And us too. So as we begin to explore the limits on those dyes, is there a lifetime risk of eating all of the jelly beans and the artificially colored chickens, etc.? You know, the FDA has established legal limits for cancer-causing contaminants in dyes, and those limits are intended to ensure that a dye will not pose a lifetime risk greater than one cancer in 1 million people. And the FDA chemists test each batch of dye to confirm that those tolerances are not exceeded. Unfortunately, the FDA's process is riddled with some problems. And I'm sure if you've looked at the track record of the FDA, you would agree that they do not get a gold star. For one thing, the tolerances that the FDA uses for exposure to these dyes are based on the 1990 dye usage, but in fact, we're using more than 50% more dye since that time. And The FDA doesn't look at the risks that dyes pose to children who are more sensitive to carcinogens and consume more dyes per unit of body weight than adults do. But what we have to realize is that some of these dyes, and there's three of them that are used all the time, the reds and yellows, that they break down into carcinogenic component called benzidine. And at least yellow number 5 and yellow number 6 far exceed the levels of dyes that we are supposed to have in our diet because of this toxic compound, benzidine. When we look at this chemical, we realize that it can mutate. And so a chemical's abilities to cause mutations or damage chromosomes is an indication that the chemical might cause cancer in humans. So that's what we look for. You know, if you get a genotoxicity study and it says that it causes changes, like yellow dye number 5, which showed positive relationship, you know, it actually damaged the DNA in the cells. It damaged the chromosomes in the cells in 6 out of 11 studies. And remember, some of these studies are done very short term. It's not like you're giving a little bit every Easter for a lifetime. You know, they're 2-year studies. And so we go back to the early 1970s when the allergist Ben Feingold from San Francisco was really the first whistleblower. He observed that food dyes and certain other synthetic and natural components of food can cause hyperactivity and impaired behaviors in children and adult patients. You know, I had a client that came in last week, and she informed me that her husband occasionally has erratic behavior. And she noted that he had erratic behavior after he sat and ate jelly beans. She got a great big bag of jelly beans, and she stashed it for the kids for Easter. And hubby got into the jelly beans, and he had a whole handful of them, and his behavior got erratic. He was hyper, he was talking fast, he was moving jerky, and she realized that this has been going on for years. So hyperactivity is not limited to kids. Impaired behavior is not limited to kids. We can certainly look at Washington, D.C. and see the impaired behavior in adults. So Ben Feingold, Dr. Feingold, recommended that parents try putting their hyperactive children on elimination diets to take certain foods out of the diet, most notably foods that contain these artificial colors. And by golly, there was a cause and effect relationship between food dyes and hyperactivity. When Feingold saw that these dyes promoted hyperactivity in hyperactive children as measured on a behavioral rating scale, and that we ought to just have a discussion about the rational use of these artificial colors that are in foods, people just poo-pooed him. Well, most people did, except in Britain, where the British government really began to look at this. And so the British government did a really beautiful study because they measured the effect of dyes. And, you know, again, one of the problems with testing sometimes is that you measure a single dye, just the effect of yellow dye number 5, just the effect of red dye number 40. And in fact, ignore the information that we get all these dyes in at one time, because we're having a yellow chicken and a red peep and like that, and they layer on each other. So the British did a smart thing, and they mixed 4 dyes and a food preservative together, and they found out that it impaired the behavior of even non-hyperactive children. So the British government told the food and restaurant industries to eliminate the dyes by the end of 2009. And they did. And the European Parliament passed a law that required a warning notice on all foods that contain one or more of the dyes. And that started 2 years ago. And the notice says that dyed food may have an adverse effect on activity and attention in children. But, oh, money talks. And so in this country, companies like McDonald's and Mars and Kraft and PepsiCo and other U.S. multinational companies make the foods in the United States with dyes in them, but they make the same food in Britain without the dyes. So they can take them out if they're required to, as the British government required them to. But in the United States, they continued to leave them in. And so when we look at the history of putting all of these dyes in foods, this argument goes back nearly 100 years. I found a citation from the Journal of Industrial and Chemical Engineering from 1914 that says America can have a coal tar dye industry if she pays the price. If America pays the price, and America is paying a price, but perhaps not the one that the journal's editors had in mind. Down through the years, more food dyes have been found to be risky than any other category of food additive. So they allowed these dyes to stay in food. They said they were safe. And then they came back years later and said, whoops. Oh, sorry. Problems. So Congress required that each batch of food dyes be tested and certified so that it had what is called acceptable levels of lead. Well, we know that lead exposure continues to accumulate in the brain, contributes to hypertension, contributes to retardation. And so food dyes got tested for lead, and they said, oh, well, it's an okay level. And they got tested for benzidine, a cancer-forming compound, and they said, oh, it's an okay level. But food additives aren't even tested in that way. When we begin to look that the word safe means that there's convincing evidence that establishes with reasonable certainty that no harm will result from the intended use of the color additive. The term convincing evidence is not a definition of safety. So you're going to make your Easter basket for your little Bobby or your little Joni, and I'll guarantee you it's going to be full of food dyes unless you make an effort for them not to be there. And you know what? There are foods. There are even candies that don't contain these artificial colors, artificial ingredients, especially the most popular ones and the ones that have been the most related to hyperactivity and bad behavior, like yellow dye number 5, yellow dye number 6, red dye number 40. You know, we used to have red dye number 8. And then they came out and they went, oops, sorry, we thought it was safe, but it causes cancer. So then they gave us red dye number 4, and then they came back and they went, whoops, sorry, that causes cancer too. So now we have red dye number 3 and red dye number 40. Red dye number 3 mostly being in candy, and red dye number 40 not only being in candy, but in soda pop and gelatin desserts and pastries and pet food and, oh, my favorite, sausage. So any of the candy-coated sausage that you have, you can bet red dye number 40 is going to be in it. It is the most widely used food dye. It may be one of the most tested dyes, but the tests that were done on the mice were flawed, they were inconclusive, and the FDA review committee acknowledged problems, but it wasn't really that big of a problem. But like the other dyes, red dye number 40 is mainly used in junk foods and occasionally used in medication. You know, I tell a story about a client in the clinic, and she was a woman that was on hormone replacement pills. And they were required by her doctor for a particular condition in her body and appropriate for her. And she came to me because she had irritable bladder. And so her family had called her thimble bladder because she had to stop the car and find every rest stop between here and Orlando and knew where every bathroom was in Sarasota. And, you know, she had to go hit the toilet just before she left the house. And first thing, as soon as she came back, and, you know, it became a joke among her friends and family of thimble bladder not being able to go for very long. She was always careful about how much liquid she drank. And so she went to the urologist and they did the cystoscope procedure and they tested her urine and they tried her on several drugs to stop this frequency and urgency that she was having, and none of them worked or were tolerant for her. And I suggested to her that it might be a food sensitivity. And she argued that because she was past 60, and she said, if I was sensitive to a food, this wouldn't have come on so suddenly. I would have had it before. And I explained that you can become sensitive to a food that you've not been sensitive to before. You might have been eating it for 40 years and then you become sensitive to it. It's not common, but it happens. And I suggested a food sensitivity test to her, and she reneged, saying that she was about to go on this 2-week tour to Europe and that she didn't want to know if she had any food sensitivities before she left, because she didn't want to trade the enjoyment that she was going to have banqueting while she was on her European trip. And I agreed, and we said we would do the food sensitivity test when she returned from her trip. A couple of days later, she called me from London, and she was freaked out because she had forgotten her hormones. She had taken all of her vitamins with her, but she had left her hormones on the counter in the kitchen and just walked out and was freaked out about whether she could be without them. And I explained to her that there was no hazard, that she could be without them, and that she could call her doctor to verify what I said. And her doctor verified the same thing, that her arms and legs were not going to fall off if she didn't have these hormones for a period of time. So during the 2 weeks that she was in England, she didn't have any frequency and urgency. Her spastic bladder stopped. And she was quite amazed, and she was convinced it was the water, or just that she was having such a good time, and maybe this thing had a nervous component to it that she hadn't acknowledged, and that it was really stress incontinence. And she speculated all sorts of things. So she had a wonderful holiday, and no frequency and no urgency, and needless to say, she didn't miss it at all. And she came home, and she got in the limo and came home from Tampa Airport and walked into her house and walked right up to her counter where her hormone pills were sitting on the counter. And she took her hormone pills, and 20 minutes later, she started with her frequency and urgency again. When we ultimately did her food sensitivity test, we also tested her for sensitivity to chemical compounds. And we often test for sensitivity to potassium nitrate and MSG and other things that can be present in foodstuffs. Turns out she had a sensitivity to these artificial colors, a number of them. Black and blue and yellow and red. She reacted to all of them. Well, guess what? They were the coloring agents that were in her hormone pills. And so 2 weeks without her hormone pills, she didn't have any reaction, walked in the door, put one in her mouth, and 20 minutes later, she started having frequency and urgency again. So I don't mean to imply in any way, shape, or form that frequency and urgency is caused by hormone pills. But in fact, when those things were compounded specially for her with no dyes, they created no problems whatsoever. It wasn't the hormones, it was the dyes. So consumer activists have long sought to persuade the FDA to ban dyes. The Center for Science and the Public Interest urged the government to ban violet number one, which is the color that the U.S. Department of Agriculture's meat inspectors used to stamp on food because it appeared to cause cancer in animal studies. So when you used to go to the grocery store and buy a steak and you saw a purple stamp on the side of the fat on the steak that said it was USDA inspected, that dye caused cancer in animal studies. By the way, the dye was banned in 1973. Public Citizens Health Research Group was a very aggressive critic of dyes all during the 1980s, and it petitioned and even sued the FDA to ban dyes. Some of these actions were based on the original laws, but even if color additives were all found to be safe, both the synthetic and the natural. They could be still be considered illegal under the Food and Drug and Cosmetics Act because they have no benefits. There's no plus for the dyes. Food colorings are added to fruit drinks and frozen desserts and gelatin desserts and salad dressings and breakfast cereals and snack food and countless other products. And they're there to conceal the absence of fruits and vegetables and ingredients that make things beneficial. Just look at the comparison between Lucky Charms and Cheerios. You know, if you want to learn more about these dyes, go up on dyediet.com. Dyediet.com does a really good job, especially of awakening parents to the fact that these cereals, all these breakfast cereals, not only are hazardous because they're loaded with sugar, they're hazardous because of the amount of coloring agents that they have. And so when we look at foreign additives, we look at something like Lucky Charms that has red dye number 40 and red dye number 10 and blue dye number 1 and blue dye number 10 and yellow dye number 6 and 8, yellow dye number 5 and 7, natural and artificial flavors, and corn syrup, and dextrose, and trisodium phosphate, and salt, and I don't know why your children don't enjoy Lucky Charms. You know, there's a better, less risky alternative from General Mills. You can find it on the same shelf, and it's Cheerios. With Cheerios, I don't have any of those coloring agents. So, yeah, I've got sugar, but I've got whole grain oats, and I've still got salt, and I've still got some preservative and some vitamin E in there, but I don't have yellow dye number 5, yellow dye number 6, blue dye number 1, red dye number 40. I got the same amount of calories. 41% of Lucky Charms by weight is sugar compared to 3.5% in Cheerios. So there's a risk. There's a risk that the U.S. food industry is giving you in a bowl. You know, I was totally astounded to see that the Wonka fruit jellies didn't contain any fruit except for some pear juice concentrate. There was flavor and there was color. There was corn syrup, but it was, there's nothing there. But at least they didn't have what we found in the fruit slices that are often sold supposedly as a healthier version of candy that had yellow dye number 5, yellow dye number 6, red dye number 40, blue dye number 1. So when you go up on dyediet.com, you can learn about some of these foods and what they contain. But, you know, it comes back to where we start no-nonsense nutrition with every week, and that's to eat food that occurs in nature. You don't have to have a PhD to tell the difference between a potato and a Pringle. You don't need a degree in nutritional science to tell the difference between a chicken nugget and a piece of chicken. Eat foods that occur in nature. I had a lady that came to me one time. She says, Eve, you have to help me with these labels. I'm having trouble understanding all these labels. And I went, well, you know, the problem is you're eating too many things that have a list of ingredients. When you look at that list of ingredients and you don't recognize the names, they're not something that would be in your pantry. Do you have maltitol, isomalt, and polyglycol syrup, sorbitol, carnauba wax, and yellow number 5 sitting in your pantry? Well, if you don't have them sitting in your pantry, why are you going to let them sit in your stomach? What we need is really, really golly food. And it brings me to the other thing that Easter reminds us of when we talk about Easter foods, and that's eggs. We want to talk about the eggs that come from chickens, not the egg roll that's around little Timmy's waistline. The official kids' treat at Easter when I was growing up was a hard-boiled egg inside a colorfully dyed shell. And you know, you can even colorfully dye your shells naturally. There are all sorts of natural ways to dye eggs. And frankly, I don't think those dyes harm us at all because they don't go inside the egg and we don't eat them. But when I was living out in Arizona and Colorado in the middle of nature land, I had neighbors that taught me to stir 2 tablespoons of paprika into a cup of boiling water and add a couple of teaspoons of white vinegar and make a beautiful red-orange egg. I found out that if I took the skins of yellow onions and simmered them in water for about 15 minutes and added a little white vinegar, I could make an orange egg. It was real easy to make a blue egg with 1/4 of a head of red cabbage cut into chunks and boiled in the water and then a couple of tablespoons of vinegar thrown in. So I could make blue eggs and orange eggs and kind of a faint red. The rich yellow eggs came from chopped carrot tops. Easy enough. All I had to do to make a brown egg was to take a cup of strong coffee and put a tablespoon of vinegar in it and put the eggs in that. I could even use grape juice and vinegar to make lavender eggs. So there's plenty of all-natural dye recipes that can be used to color your eggs, but I want to endorse eggs. You know I'm a big fan of eggs. That's a reason here on No Nonsense Nutrition I'm always being an egg hustler. You know, when I realized that women that eat 6 eggs a week reduce their risk of breast cancer by 44%, that's a pretty good reason to eat eggs right there. They're low cost, they're high quality protein. You know, there's nothing that gives us better quality protein on a percent per ounce basis than eggs do. But the most important thing about eggs is that choline. And you know I've talked about choline before because it benefits your brain. Our bodies can produce some choline, but we can't make enough to have an adequate supply. And it's a nutrient that's really needed for good health. It's a component in the fat-containing structures in the cell membrane, where the flexibility of the cell membrane is really dependent on an adequate supply of choline. These fat-like molecules are a big part of the brain's total mass, so it's important for brain function. And choline is an important molecule for a cellular process called methylation. Some people have heard about methylation, where we move methyl groups from one end of a molecule to the other. This is how you turn genes on and off. And so you want to be able to methylate. But choline is also an important component of acetylcholine. Choline and acetylcholine, that's the neurotransmitter that carries messages to the nerves. And it's the primary way that we lay down memory. Plus, choline reduces inflammation. So it's a fat that's good for your brain. It helps your liver methylate toxins. It helps your memory. That's pretty astounding. Plus, people who have the highest average intake of choline, doesn't matter whether it comes from egg yolks or soybeans, they have the lowest rate of inflammatory markers. They have low rates of C-reactive protein and tumor necrosis factor and interleukin 6 and things you may not have heard about. But suffice it to say, all of these chronic inflammation markers are connected to conditions from heart disease to osteoporosis to cognitive decline to type 2 diabetes. When the Journal of Clinical Nutrition, the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, went to look at the Mediterranean diet and say, why does the Mediterranean diet work so well to reduce inflammation? It turned out that it was in large part because of choline. So when we look at those Easter eggs, we want to get those eggs in our diet. A friend of mine was making an egg salad sandwich the other day, and I looked at that green ring around the egg yolks, which is sulfur, by the way, and I realized that if you put the eggs in cold water and bring them to a boil and just let them boil for a minute and put a lid on and pull them off the stove and just let them sit in the water as it cools, you can completely hard cook an egg and never end up with a green ring. But boy, do I have to get all of my intellectual guns loaded to try to convince people who have been hustled by the cholesterol myth around eggs to go back to eating eggs. You know, with 90% of Americans being choline deficient, we need to be eating eggs. They are the richest source of choline, the egg yolks themselves. Now, soybeans and spinach and beets also contain some choline. But I have to tell you, I can't eat enough soybeans and spinach and beets to get the choline that I can get in a couple of eggs. Now, liver also contains choline, but unless you knew the animal on a first name basis and it's organic, I wouldn't be eating livers, whether they were from cows or anything else. We can get some choline in wheat germ and a little bit in chicken and salmon and other fishes, but it's all in the yolk. That yolk contains a great deal of this choline, sometimes as phosphatidylcholine. That is the most common form in which choline is incorporated into our cell membranes. But when you don't have choline, it's way easier for you to develop fatty liver, and it's way easier to develop muscle damage. So choline not only benefits us in terms of reducing inflammation, fluffing up our brain, helping to methylate toxins, making neurotransmitters healthy, reducing breast cancer risks, but all of those things together added up, it also helps us to reduce the risk of fatty liver. But the thing that blew my mind about eggs was individuals losing weight faster when they were eating eggs. They did a beautiful trial where they divided a group of obese men and women into two groups, and one of them ate two eggs for breakfast every day, and the other one had a bagel. And they had the same amount of calories and the same amount of mass. And they ate their breakfast at least 5 days a week for 8 weeks as part of a low-fat diet. And the egg eaters lost twice as much weight. The egg eaters lost an average of 6 pounds in 8 weeks compared to the bagel eaters' 3.5-pound weight loss. Now, all of them were on a 1,000-calorie deficit diet. But the egg eaters had a greater decrease in their waist circumference, and they reported greater improvements in their energy. So we see eggs benefiting heart health all the way across the board, and this nonsense about eggs' high cholesterol levels is exactly nonsense. It's nonsense in terms of how it affects your cholesterol. The cholesterol on your plate does not affect your serum cholesterol. They took 224 studies that were done on cholesterol and eggs, and they were carried out over the last 25 years on over 8,000 people. And what the investigators in the study found was that cholesterol never affected blood cholesterol levels. What affected blood cholesterol levels was saturated fat. So not only have studies shown that eggs don't significantly affect cholesterol in most individuals, but they actually result in improvement in one's lipid profiles. Even when people's cholesterol levels rise, they reduce the bad LDL. What we know now is that LDL is the lousy cholesterol, but even within LDL, there's LDL-A and LDL-B. And so what we found out that the people who have the risky LDL phenotype B will shift their molecules to the low-risk LDL phenotype A after just 1 month of eating whole eggs. But it doesn't stop there. I know it sounds like an infomercial, and more to come. There's also protection against age-related macular degeneration and cataracts. Lutein, which is the carotenoid that we find in spinach and dandelion greens and marigolds, we know helps to prevent age-related macular degeneration and cataracts. So the American Dietetic Association published a remarkable study that found that these natural lutein compounds that are found in eggs are more bioavailable than in any purified lutein product. So very many of you go to the eye doctor and they give you a recommended supplement that contains lutein. And yet, lutein, both in eggs and in spinach, and so you know why I like having spinach with eggs, we absorb that lutein much better from an egg yolk than we do from anything else. Now, even though egg yolks contain significantly less lutein than spinach, they are a much more bioavailable source than spinach, simply because the lutein is trapped in the fats, and lutein's bioavailability is likely due to the fats like cholesterol and choline that are found in the egg yolk. So all carotenoids are fat soluble, so they can't be absorbed unless fat is present. So that's why when I made my carrot salad yesterday, I put a little bit of mayonnaise in it because it allows us to absorb the beta carotene better. So if you want to maximally boost your lutein absorption, you combine eggs and spinach together, and that's a breakfast I look forward to several days a week. So whether you like your spinach steamed or sautéed or fresh in a spinach salad, if you dress it with a little olive oil or top it with a chopped hard-boiled egg, you're going to increase the amount of lutein availability and protect your eyes from macular degeneration. Eating eggs even lowers the risk of heart attack or stroke by helping to prevent blood clots. There's a protein in an egg yolk that inhibits platelet aggregation, the amount of time it takes for the blood to make a clot. That's a pretty big list of goodies when you talk about reducing macular degeneration and cataracts, helping to prevent blood clots, helping to prevent breast cancer, increasing neurotransmitter health, you know, absolutely making a difference in terms of your cholesterol profile, changing the fats in your brain, helping to methylate out toxins. Do you see that it compares uniquely against food dyes in candy? And you might say, well, Eve, eggs and candy, how are you going to make a comparison? It's easy. It's Easter week. Eggs are exceptional food. They are whole foods. They are prepackaged sources of carbohydrates, protein, fat, and micronutrients. Everything is needed there for a developing chick. And so we know darn good and well that Easter eggs are going to beat out Easter dyes by a mile. Now, you're probably still going to have your peeps. There's usually 5 in a pack, only 3 in the sugar-free pack, 140 calories, 36 grams of carbs. So if you were on the South Beach diet, you could eat one bag of Pips and that would be it for 2 days. You can have jelly beans. I loved it when I looked up jelly beans and found out there were 140 calories and 37 beans. Why in the world would they measure 37 beans? 32 grams of sugar. Malted milk eggs, 190 calories in 7 eggs. All the fat was saturated. But when I looked further down the list, some of them malted milk eggs, you only had to have 5 to get a serving. Even Hershey's Kisses with almonds, they gave 9 pieces as equal to a serving, 230 calories. Biggest problem that you'll have is to get your family to agree on what a serving is. So I like to go back to when the hard-boiled egg in the colorfully dyed shell was, you know, the mainstay of Easter. I had a great time coloring eggs as a kid. I loved putting the decals on them, and I loved using the wax crayons to make various designs on the eggs. It really took the emphasis off the candy. And I remember talking to my mom and saying, you know, when I get bigger, I get more candy. And my mother said, oh, no, it's the opposite. As you get bigger, you get less candy. Because the Easter Bunny knows you're bigger now. I never really understood what that meant. I just knew that we could stash the peeps in the freezer and they would still be good months later. Well, now, thanks to the preservatives that are in there and my favorite Carnauba wax, we don't have to worry about them ever going bad. In fact, you can buy those marshmallow peeps today and you can will them to your grandchildren because they'll still be good. And if you ever have a day that maltitol, isomalt, polyglycol, syrup, sorbitol, gelatin, calcium chloride, natural flavors, yellow dye number 5, sucralose, potassium sorbate, and Carnauba wax are your list of favorite foods to eat, then you'll know that sugar-free peeps can go on the top of that list.